Welcome to Who Knew? We are fans of the current series of Doctor Who, and here we discuss our likes, dislikes, and insights into the modern regeneration of the show.
Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast. All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com. You can leave comments there, or email us at WhoKnewPodcast@gmail.com. We also have an Instagram and Twitter account. Tweet at us at WhoKnewPodcast, and find us on Facebook.
Today we're taking a quick trip in the TARDIS with Classic Who.
It's Who Classic. Classic.
Today's episode is The Ark in Space. It's the second serial of the 12th season. This serial is written by Robert Holmes with an original idea from John Lucarati. It's directed by Rodney Bennett. It originally aired on the 25th of January through the 15th of February, 1975. Part 2 got the highest ratings of 13.6 million viewers. The Fourth Doctor is played by Tom Baker. Sarah Jane Smith is played by Elizabeth Sladen. Harry Sullivan is played by Ian Martyr. Hi, this is Eugene. Let's introduce ourselves.
Hi, this is Frank.
This here's Josh.
Hello, this is Auburn.
Hey, y'all. This is Kelsey.
Hi, this is Brian.
So this is the first time we're talking about a story that stars the Fourth Doctor.
Yes.
Arguably the most famous actor portrayal of the Doctor. He's also the longest running Doctor for 7 years, I believe it was.
On screen.
Yeah, definitely on screen.
And then Sarah Jane Smith, we've seen before. Mm-hmm. She was with the Third Doctor. And we've seen her in the modern series with School Reunion.
And I think this is the one Doctor that, even if somebody has no idea what Doctor Who is, this Doctor has, like, punched through into popular culture, and he's the weird guy with the scarf.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So when, if you don't know Doctor Who, you still know.
Oh, that guy.
That guy.
When I was a kid, he's all I knew of what Doctor Who is because of Starlog magazine.
Yep.
So this Ark in Space happens to be the second story with Tom Baker. The first story was the one previous to this being Robot, and previous to that was Planet of the Spiders, where Jon Pertwee regenerated into Tom Baker. And Harry Sullivan's first appearance was in Robot, the one previous to this story. Harry Sullivan, I'm talking about Harry because we know who Sarah Jane is. She was a journalist with Jon Pertwee in The Time Warrior, which we covered. And Harry is with UNIT, and he's a Royal Navy doctor. And he's the surgeon for UNIT, and then the doctor decides to take him on the trip with him and Sarah Jane at the end of Robot.
And this is also the beginning of the time of the doctor traveling through space and time again. Because in Pertwee's era, he couldn't use the TARDIS. He was earthbound. So now that he has the TARDIS back, he's beginning to use it.
Oh, that's fine.
Does he travel in it in Robot, or does Robot take place all in the present?
It takes place all in the present. But what's funny about Robot is that he uses Betsy, the car. And I'm like, don't you dare use the Third Doctor's car.
Wow. I don't remember that. So this is the first time in years that the Doctor has traveled through time and space.
Well, in Time Warrior, Pertwee used it to go back in the past.
Oh, that's true.
With
yes,
Sarah right. Jane.
What episode is this in the season?
Two. Serial-wise. I mean,
yeah, so there was an episode before.
There were, yeah.
And he traveled
there
in the TARDIS.
There was a story.
In that episode or only at the end of it?
At the end. At the very end, he, Harry, and Sarah Jane jump in, and then it. This is weird because it takes place literally right after that ends. The TARDIS arrives on a seemingly abandoned space station carrying the Doctor, Sarah Jane, and new companion Harry Sullivan. The Doctor does not know where or when they landed, but this time he knows why. Harry pressed buttons that he shouldn't have. The station is powered down and has minimal oxygen. The Doctor restores some power, and Harry's bad habit of pressing buttons happens again. And a door on the opposite side of the room slides open. Sarah goes through the door into a small office that has a console and a lab bed. The door closes behind her, trapping her inside.
That's some high-tech space station on the outside. Isn't it?
You said that this episode is coming right after Robot, which was set modern day?
They're modern, yes.
They're
present.
Modern
1975.
Day. Sure, sure. Because Sarah walks out of the TARDIS carrying a gas lamp?
Yeah, that was weird.
Was that like...
That was weird.
Okay. And what the Doctor would have thought would be a pure oxygen environment.
Not necessarily pure, but...
Well, you
but
don't
also
like,
it's like the Doctor could have turned and said, by the way, there's not much oxygen, turn the flame off.
Yeah, I thought of that as well.
Yeah, I just thought it was such an interesting, like, lighting source to have from the TARDIS, where the Doctor was carrying, like, a proper torch, I think, flashlight
to us, yeah.
Yes, but, yeah, I was just like, what? Why?
Did that have anything to do with the prior episode?
No.
I
just the quirkiness of the 70s, yeah. I think. Or,
and I also love when he finally does get the lights on. You see Elizabeth Sladen's like, she blows out the lantern. And she's like, what do I do with this? Yeah. So I'm just going to put it on the ground here next to the door.
I think what would have been better is that Sarah Jane walks out with a lantern and Harry walks out with a cage and a canary.
By the way, if you're running out of oxygen in that room, go into the TARDIS.
Yeah. Problem solved. But something that I do like is how the Doctor mentions the Helmick regulator to Harry, and that was referenced in Time Crash when the Fifth Doctor and the Tenth Doctor are in. He's saying something about the Helmick regulator, so that's another reference.
Oh, cool.
I found it interesting that when you first see the TARDIS, the door isn't facing camera. I almost thought like, because you heard them before you saw them, and I thought like, do they not even have a door on this TARDIS? Are they just going to like come out from behind it? But when I did see there, they did come out from inside it, but it was really hidden. And I even thought like, even if they don't have the budget, they could have maybe just faced camera a little bit more.
What I love is there's no effect. The TARDIS is sitting on the set the entire shot.
Right.
But the lighting. Come on. It's the lighting that they're just kind of like, okay, the top light on the TARDIS comes on, and then they start to, you know, bring up the set lights a little bit. And it's like, it was on the second viewing that I'm like, hey, that's a cheat.
Well, it kind of works because the space station, which was sort of powered down.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But, yeah.
But it is just kind of like a production cheat. They didn't spend any money on an effect.
Well, that's the one thing that I found the most, you know, despite how dated this was, I was impressed by the ingenuity of what they had to work with.
Yeah.
And filmmaking wise. Like, you could tell, ingenious. Like, they're pretty consummate filmmakers. And like, well, this is what we have. They're like the guys in Apollo 13. We got to fit this into this using only this. So all the ideas that they had, I actually found quite
endearing.
Inventive.
Well, I guess the other form of ingenuity would be ingenious, but that sounds like a big word.
I'm glad they didn't show the inside, because sometimes when they do it, it doesn't look right.
Well, yeah, I'm not as familiar. So, yeah.
And also remember, during this time period, it's not like the modern show that we're used to, where the doors are the same on the inside and outside of the TARDIS.
Right.
In the classic show, you went through the police call box doors, and when you're in the TARDIS, they look different. They look futuristic for the time period.
The old inside-outside door trick.
Exactly. And that's why people kind of, like, there was a reaction to it going, wow, you can see the real doors with, you know, Christopher Eccleston. And also, usually the interior was just black. Wasn't it just black?
It was just really lit dimly, so you didn't see inside.
Has the Doctor done the gravity test yet? I love the gravity test. He uses a yo-yo for a gravity test.
He will just wrap it around his finger. Whenever he pulls out that yo-yo, he just holds the string. It's really weird.
Well, he's not the best yo-yo player. Oh.
He's only using it to test gravity, not his skills.
He's not having fun. This is a scientific experiment.
Walking the dog.
He will do that again.
Yeah.
We'll mention that later.
And only because we just recorded Silence in the Library, when Sarah Jane walks through that open door, I'm like, no, the Vashta Narada are in there.
Kind of funny that you should bring that up, because...
Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat both say that The Ark in Space is their favorite story from the classic Who.
Huh.
The Doctor estimates that no one has touched anything for nearly 10,000 years. They notice Sarah Jane is missing and reactivate the door to find her unconscious on the floor due to the lack of oxygen. They move her to the bed as the door slides shut again. The Doctor finds out that the wires to the controls have been bitten through. He fixes them and air flows once again. They leave Sarah Jane to rest and go back to the main room. Now that power is back, an automated defense system shoots at them. They use a desk as cover and make their way to the control panel, deactivating the defenses.
The two of them cowering under the desk and moving it along.
Oh, I thought that was great.
It is, but it's just, it's a different time for storytelling.
And they use the ingenuity of unscrewing it from the floor. Like, I found...
He used the screwdriver as a screwdriver. Yeah. That was excellent. I like that.
But they're on a space station. It would be screwed down.
Two things I noticed. I liked how danger kicked in very quickly in this episode. They can't breathe. She passes out. That she's trapped in there. Like, but then they, when they realize she's trapped, or they put her on the bed, then they're kind of very relaxed about any sort of, you know, trouble that Sarah Jane may be in compared to themselves. And
It reminded me of Back to the Future 2, where they put Jennifer on the
The universe will just completely change around her, and she'll wake up.
That's what that reminded me of.
Yeah. They have a moment of, oh no, and then, oh okay, she's, you know, only almost dying now, not just dying. And then they just leave her in there in the same room she got trapped in before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I did like how they moved her to the lab bed, because Harry was very conscious that she's wearing a short skirt and was holding it as he's laying it down, and holds down the skirt so that it doesn't ride up.
That was on the commentary, because Sarah Jane or Elizabeth said to Ian,
Harry,
that my skirt is really short and they're going to put me on this bed. And he goes, I got you covered. Oh. And sure enough, he got her covered.
Literally and figuratively. Yeah. And he does it really well, because I didn't notice it until you pointed it out. Either. And now I'll never not see it.
I guess I've been in situations, you know, back in school and stuff, where you're doing something and you have to cover the other performer.
Oh, you theater people.
You know, and so you just do that and try and...
So we also have a moment here where he uses his sonic screwdriver to fix wires. I do not have a problem with this wire fixing, because he's just basically soldering two broken wires together. Mm-hmm. It's not creating a wire from nothing like in The Doctor Dances.
Is this the first time we've seen us as a group, the sonic screwdriver in Classic?
I want to say yes.
Oh, really?
Tomb of the Cybermen? No.
Did the second Doctor get a Cybermat? No, he did electric.
Yeah, that wasn't a screwdriver.
Yeah, it wasn't a screwdriver.
And then the TV movie, he used it incorrectly.
That's right.
But yeah, this is the sonic screwdriver being used. I was like,
same sound effect.
Yeah. That's what I was like.
And the TARDIS is the same sound as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of the production, did you notice that the floor with the stencils of the grate?
No.
All those stencils, those are all done with, somebody had to go in and do all those little holes that look like grating for the floor.
Oh,
really?
I did notice that. It looked good.
Yeah, because it's really a soundstage studio floor.
Uh-huh.
And they just went in and did them all.
Oh my gosh. I will say the set was pretty impressive overall for like the scope of it.
The one thing that I don't like is when Sarah Jane is knocking on the door. I'm like, that's plywood.
Oh, yeah.
It looks good, but it doesn't sound.
They should have done something like with the sound design.
When the doors open and close, is obvious. They don't do it smoothly. It's some stagehand back there pulling it.
10,000 years. No, I'm just kidding.
I like Harry has one brief little comment. Thrown off comment that might have played better back in 1975, because he says, I hate sliding doors.
Uh-huh.
And he also said, you know, I got one hit me on the nose. And it's like, oh, that's right. In 1975, those would have been really, really rare.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been just a grocery store probably having the mat where you had to step on the mat and it swung open. But like sliding doors like we have today didn't exist.
I guess not.
It was,
I remember,
you know,
that
futuristic
that.
From Star Trek.
I remember him saying that. I thought it was kind of some reference I didn't know about.
Yeah, no,
from
nobody
episode.
In 1975 there were not sliding doors common.
I forgot about that, and having to stand on the mat for it to open.
Yeah,
and it would slide. It wouldn't slide into the wall. It would just push open like a Disney ride's doors.
Yeah.
Stay behind the yellow line. The doors are moving towards you.
Yeah, and they had a railing.
Yeah, they had a railing.
So people wouldn't walk in the way and get hit by the door opening.
And as a little kid, you'd go and jump onto the mat, make the door open.
I remember doing that.
Yeah. Sarah Jane's bed is also a transporter, because, you know, and sends her to another section of the station. Here she is sedated and prepared for suspended hibernation. The Doctor and Harry realize Sarah Jane is gone and begin to search for her. In a corridor, Harry sees a large green form, but it disappears before they reach it.
Hooray.
Leaving behind only a trail of slime. They find the room that prepared Sarah Jane, but she is no longer there. The Doctor finds an inventory and concludes that they are on an ark of some kind. I do like it, because at this point, Harry's starting to say things that are actually helpful and good. This might be a little bit early, but he's like, oh, this is a survival kit. So he's already concluded something happened to the Earth and they needed to get off, and this is their way of doing that. And I do love the Doctor at this point, where he's like, you know, you're starting to think, Harry. That's great. My influence, so don't take any credit for it.
Yeah, I wrote that too.
Yeah, I love that. That's very, very fourth Doctor Tom Baker.
I think I missed all that because I was asleep. And this first episode was so hard for me to get through. I could not get myself into a state of, this is the 70s way of doing things. This is the British 70s way of doing things.
So and it's the 60s.
Oh, it's, but I mean, right. But this one was a struggle for me to watch. This was a really hard one to get through.
The pace is really slow. If the whole thing could have been just two half-hour episodes.
I think that would have been a lot better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Some of the props that were used for production in the Ark were reused from consoles used in Gerry Anderson's UFO sets.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, that was in mid-70s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay.
So if we know Gerry Anderson, he does Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, which is my favorite of his. And
UFO Stingray. Was a live-action show.
Yeah, and Stingray.
Yeah, Stingray. I think so.
Well, there was a point where they walk in there, and there's what ends up being a medical table that they roll across the floor. I had that. When it was red. I had it in the 80s, though.
Oh.
And like, I actually texted my sister a picture of it. I'm like, look what's supposed to be 10,000 years in the future. She's like, you still have that? I'm like, I might have it in storage. That thing like went to college with me. It went, you know, and I got that in the 80s. So somewhere in the 70s, they made a mold of that and like milked it for 10 years or more.
One thing gets me about the way it's filmed is that it definitely feels like it's on a stage. Like you could be sitting in an audience because it's only three walls and you don't feel like there is a fourth wall there.
It's true. To me, it's like a sitcom. The way
it's just filmed like a sitcom.
And they kept using the same hallways, just shot from different, you know, the opposite angles. Because then they'll walk over to where action happened and it's literally 2 feet from them. Right. But they cut away like it's another room.
And they didn't hear what was going on.
Right.
Two feet away from them.
Or see many of the props that are lying on the ground. Right next to them.
But I do love the corridor with the windows.
Yeah.
It's cheesy. Yeah. It doesn't look good, but you just kind of, that's cool. And I bet, you know, if you were like a 10-year-old kid in 1975 or
But they made it work seven, as with what they had.
Like, they a lot of those filmmakers on the show or whatever probably thought, God, if this was just film, damn this video. Because video, you know, makes everything look ridiculously cheesy. Like the thing that they were doing in the beginning with the space station.
Oh my gosh, the model?
Yeah, but filmmaking wise and what it did, it worked perfectly. It just looked so bad because this video quality, you know, has no depth to it.
But it did look a little bit better, I think, when it was broadcast back then.
Well, yeah, because on a television in 1975, it probably looked 10 times better.
Right.
On your little magpie TV
set. Yeah, because it wasn't made.
We are seeing this a lot clearer than it was ever intended to be.
Well, that's why
I thought they were always smaller back in the day.
Oh, no.
Not 1975.
Okay.
But,
How old do you think we are?
21-inch to 24-inch, I think, would be...
I mean, they're smaller than they are today, standard. Like a regular... I had a 13-inch black and white forever.
Yes, I had a TV in my bedroom that was this big.
Yeah, I think 13-inch was...
it's not the size that matters.
I'm saying stuff would look better if it was smaller.
Yeah.
Yes. And black and white. And grainy. Well, like there's those mats in Star Wars that you see around some of the spaceships because bulbs weren't so bright back then that, you know, no one saw that and just with the regular optical the projection.
Yeah, but that Starfield, I still, like, praise them for what they did back then. And I kept thinking, there's no glass. It's just empty space.
It's force field.
It's clear glass.
Was there some sort of membrane separating the outside from the inside, keeping in the air? It's
transparent aluminum.
Something else that kind of dates this episode, when Sarah first wakes up, I think it's before they put her on the final bed, but today where I think maybe they would offer her tea or something, they instantly go to brandy. It just jumped out at me because I'm just not used to hearing that and seeing that.
It's so old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the TARDIS has brandy.
Yeah, I know. There's a bottle like just back in the TARDIS always. Yeah. So that was one thing that kind of jumped out to me as like a product of this time, this culture.
Because remember in the Looney Tunes cartoons, they had the Saint Bernard going and rescuing people.
Yeah.
And always inside, he had the little bottle of brandy.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what they had, you know, to heat you up.
But then he would drink it himself.
Which was the joke.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you should give that to the person who's unconscious.
Was Saint Bernard the patron saint of alcohol?
St. Patrick.
Oh, that's right.
Something happened to the Earth, and they housed the plants and animals on the station so that they can return to the Earth once the crisis was over. Thousands of humans are also stored here in suspended animation. Harry looks around, finding an empty pod with a slime trail leading to a ventilation duct, and then he finds a suspended Sarah Jane in another pod. The doctor has Harry look for a resuscitation device, but instead Harry finds a 6-foot-tall insect. It is dead, and has been dead for such a long time it is almost mummified.
Okay, before we talk about that, here is the quote from the doctor about humanity. Homo sapiens, what an inventive, invincible species. It's only been a few million years since they crawled up out of the mud and learned to walk. Puny, defenseless bipeds. They've survived flood, famine, and plague. They've survived cosmic wars and holocausts. And now, here they are, out among the stars, waiting to begin a new life, ready to outsit eternity. They're indomitable. Indomitable. And to me, that really captures what Russell has been doing about the ordinary man, about humanity, and about how they're resilient and they press forward into space. And I like that that is consistent with what we know of modern Who and classic Who.
It's a perfect example. And, you know, when we were talking about camera angles and cheap doing things quickly, production, not that scene. Because that scene, they actually go up, the camera actually goes above Tom Baker, who's tall. And then, you know, he's looking up. It really gives it a good scale.
Yeah, just like when we did Tomb of the Cybermen, very much like that scene, where you can see the scale of that set.
Well, speaking of that show, that this set reminded me a lot of that. Because
very much.
Of the obvious.
I did like the one line where he says that, you know, humans are asleep. And someone, I think it's a doctor, but it might be Sarah Jane, says the entire human race awaiting the trumpet blast. That's a nice little, just throw that out there and move on.
Yeah.
It's biblical.
Oh. I thought it was still an interesting turn of phrase.
Yes, the trumpet blasts at the second coming.
The second coming of Christ.
Oh, well, that's even that's interesting. I just thought, like, you know. Yeah. Oh, Gabriel. And I just thought, like, say it for me.
Revelation?
Yeah, no, you know. Revelry. Thank you.
Oh.
I have a hard time saying that word. That's what I thought.
The thing I had to say was before this. So it's when Sarah Jane is first transmatted to the sleep pod. But when I was watching it, I didn't yet know that, oh, they're all cryogenically frozen. And it felt a lot like a suicide, like, pod.
Yes.
Like Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, because the prime
minister. The woman, the prime minister's or the leader of Earth's voice, she comes on and she says, you know, preparing for your death.
Your sacrifice. Yeah. And I think she even has them put their personal effects in something they call a coffin right next to them.
I think that's, I think you're supposed, maybe that's why I thought that Sarah Jane was in danger, because you're supposed to think this thing is going to kill her. That's
supposed to think she's in danger. Danger, so.
And that's when she starts fighting back and trying to get out, but the sedation is too much.
Right. And originally I was like, oh, are they making a commentary on like the British health system or something? But then it turns out she's just cryogenically frozen and not really in danger. So.
And the sacrifice is you left Earth early, giving up your
family.
Your family and things like that, because you're the,
before the
chosen,
solar
the chosen elite.
I thought it was going to go one way, and then, I mean, by the end of this episode, I went a different way, but...
What I did find interesting, I'm getting a little ahead here, but all the little questions I had that I thought they were going to cheese out because of early television storytelling, they really thought, like, well, what about this? And then they would explain that. Like, they kept, especially the doctor, kept bringing up the logistical points that I was like, well, they're probably going to chintz around this, and then they would deal with it. And I thought the writing was very good, considering the production value, if you want to call it that.
I'm really glad that they did have the doctors say the line, this is the human race, all colors, all creeds, all nationalities are here.
Yes.
I'm really glad that line is there, because then all the actors are still white.
Because of the time period, I don't know how political it was, rather than at that time period, we were more united. I remember, you know, the whole 60s, and it's like, so, I mean, there, how much...
In the 70s, we were torn apart.
Not at this point, because we're still doing, you know, Hands Across America and all this kind of
stuff.
That
was the 80s.
Oh, what was going on in the 70s? It just felt...
I'd like to teach the world to sing.
I know the 70s.
The Coca-Cola commercial was on.
When I went to school, there were people from all over the world.
Yeah, that's true.
So it was something that was...
It was post-60s.
We were still in that kind of, we are united... glow of the early 70s, that people were trying to...
The Cold War.
The children.
Had that hippie mentality, strive and go, we are one. We are one race of humans. And
I like to buy the world a Coke. That was...
I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so that was still going on. So I think that was more reflecting of that rather than trying to be politically correct like we would be today, trying to say those type of things. That's what I'm.
Oh, I see your point. Yes, I don't think they were trying to be politically correct. I think they were just
a reflection
of the time that there were a feeling of movement at that period in our own history.
We were
coming together and we were acknowledging other races,
even though all the actors were white.
Diversity,
which. There were non-white actors way earlier in Doctor Who.
Right.
But even though all the actors are white, they were being progressive to say, no, everybody got saved.
Right.
They are making a point to point out these things and even the riding the line of sexism throughout the episode and the shows that they poke fun at it so the women can stand up. So it's obvious, it seems like it's sexist, but really it's in favor of the women's movement.
Does reflect the men of the time.
Right.
You know, I mean, I had a lot of uncles
who
would be Harry.
But it's not written with that point of view. It's written as though this guy's wrong.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. But that type of thinking was new.
Very new, yeah.
Ish. I mean, the 60s.
Yeah, like when he turns to her and he's like, well, I bet that, you know, satisfied your feminist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
It's funny because.
While at the same time, she's saying, if you call me old one more time, I'm going to spit in your face.
Right, right. I did find it a little funny that, you know, we just have this in the night. It's 2018 now, and we have the wage difference is happening. How many years later is this? And they're kind of pointing a finger at it then, you know, like, God, things like this have just been happening forever.
Mm-hmm. I was just saying, up to now, this is the first episode of this four-parter. So this is all what happened in that first 25 minutes.
Yeah, a lot happens.
Yeah, but that cliffhanger, like, what is that?
I mean, it's a
body. Slow cliffhanger?
The body falling toward Harry.
Yeah, I know, but it was no scream, no noise. He slowly opens the thing, it's there, and it kind of falls out.
But the cliffhanger was, is it attacking?
Yeah. Right.
You didn't know that it was dead.
Yeah. And if I was even watching that, if I was a 8-year-old watching that, just the way it would have scared the heck out of me.
Yeah.
They find a med kit as one of the crew starts to wake up. She grabs items from the kit and injects herself. She tells them that she is a doctor named Vyra, and they ask her to help Sarah Jane. She coldly injects Sarah Jane, telling them if it doesn't kill her, she will be all right. She then goes to another pod and awakes their leader, Lazar, a.k.a. Noah. They were to awake centuries ago, but the insect altered their hibernation cycle by biting through the wires. But to what purpose?
No, you have to look aloofly off to the distance and go, what purpose?
So why did Vyra start to wake up? Because they noticed her starting to wake up. It wasn't like they did anything.
They fixed the wires to get out of that room earlier.
But why would that cause her to wake up?
Because now the system's running again. Because the insect bit through all the wires, not just
and
air.
She's a doctor, so she should wake up first.
So she's programmed to her and then the technicians before going to the general.
And I was
going to
say that med kit looked like a toy toolbox where I put like Legos or something in it. Yeah. I was like, what? Well, really?
I think a lot of this stuff was new back then.
You're focusing on.
I'm trying to focus on things. You're trying to focus on things. We're looking off in the distance. I don't know.
When you're talking about the acting, though, that was such stereotypical of the time of the cold, futuristic speech of human beings.
Oh, you think that's why they were like that?
Yeah.
They even say,
we can't understand your
colonial.
Your talk.
There were a lot of pauses, though.
You know, I mean, because, like, Harry and Sarah Jane are like, what are they? I can't understand them. And then the futuristic humans are like, they have a weird way of speaking.
You know what? I would agree with you, but when the technicians awake later, they're not like that.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Part of the set, the noise of the set really jumped out to me when the Vyra woke up. And you could hear the squeaking of the styrofoam
yes.
out of the cutouts that they were all in underneath the clear plastic domes.
Like vacuum.
Do you see they open it up and where their heads are stuck in?
Yeah.
It's all jagged because the styrofoam was like cut with a handsaw kind of a thing.
Again, it's like a little bit of sound design would have fixed all of that.
Yeah. Well, they never, I mean, I don't know how it worked.
It's all, yeah, it's videotaped.
Then, but yeah, like, it's just everything that happened is there. Yeah.
Like back then, Doctor Who was more of a theatrical production. Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. this was live. You did it in camera, and you did it on the day. That's why in Tomb of the Cybermen, they're stepping over each other's lines, or they're flubbing, but then they continue because mm-hmm. there's no, can't go back and redo that.
Right, right.
So I think they carried that over when video technology became available.
Yeah, and I think some of it was probably economics, because when you're shooting a long take with film, like, it's not like today with video and digital where you can cut and reshoot as much as you want because mm-hmm. it doesn't cost anything. Mm-hmm. But there, like, once you started filming, that's money, like, going through the projector or through the camera. So you have to keep going and, you know, whatever you get.
I don't know
if it
was
video,
though. I don't know how expensive was it.
Video was new at
the
time.
BBC was video indoors, film outside. And boy, when you're watching something, that's a harsh cut. Yeah.
I thought it was funny that they nicknamed him Noah, which is a joke, which is good, but they constantly call him Noah, and they just dump his real name.
Yeah. Yeah. That was kind of weird. It was like, why even mention it? Just call him Noah.
Especially for a society that doesn't seem to joke much.
But she even says, we deemed it humorous.
Right. Right.
Or something like that. I also like when Virus says to them, is she important? Is she of value?
Yes. Right,
is she of value? And Harry's like stuttering through, well, yeah, this, and this. And the doctor just goes, yes.
The power fluctuates, and the doctor goes to the station's power source. There, he finds a huge larva inside the solar collectors, feeding on the solar energy. Meanwhile, Noah isn't happy and doesn't want their kind to infect his crew. So, he orders Sarah Jane and Harry to leave. He runs into the doctor and stuns him after learning the doctor was in the solar collector. Noah goes down there himself to investigate, where the larva touches his left hand and he faints.
So we may be inclusive at this point to all types of races and creeds, but they're still the upper class.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is still
so
a British
still
show.
Class with the
there's still classism going on.
Because he doesn't want their kind, because everyone's been picked out to be, you know, so genetically wonderful.
And he calls them regressives.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and it was the doctor that had the dream of, oh, this must be all of the diverse, right. like, mm-hmm. all kinds of people. And then the reality that Noah's there is like, no, these are the cream of the crop, or if they had to pass some test, or maybe economics, yeah.
And according to the other technicians that come out later, yeah, I think it's only Noah's idea. Yeah. You know, he's alone. And maybe, you know, Vira.
She's also a
but
doctor,
I don't know if everybody who's on the ship agrees with that.
Maybe that, what was his name? Drone? No,
Dune?
Dune, yeah. Maybe he was like the calming influence on that, on those other two at the top.
In the solar collector, the green spray painted green bubble wrap. But then you have that eye. And I was like, how did you do the eye? That's kind of cool.
Speaking of the bubble wrap, that slime trail of bubble wrap from Dune's pod to the vent that is there the whole time that everybody must walk by and see, and nobody ever, like, none of the crew ever is like, oh, what happened to Dune? What's this green streak going to that vent? Like,
yeah.
Dune's at it again.
I thought the larva can really move around well. I mean, it can open doors, open the solar collector, get inside, and close it behind him. So it still has appendages.
When it gets larger and there's obviously someone in there, like a sleeping bag, I was like, so is his head there or is his head there? What do they do? I mean, I thought the inventiveness of how they made all this stuff work was very good.
And bubble wrap was new, right?
Yeah, we'd never seen bubble wrap, so that's why they used it.
Oh, I was going to ask that because later,
it was a futuristic substance.
Yeah, when his hand, they used bubble wrap for a lot of the makeup.
Yeah.
So I was looking at it, I'm like, well, it actually looks pretty good. And if you don't know what bubble wrap is, then that looks pretty good.
I mean, nowadays, I like how his hand is the small bubble wrap, wrap, and then the one in the collector is the big bubble wrap. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, use all kinds.
So when did bubble wrap reach the masses?
It was invented in 1957.
Oh. Well, I also think back then people weren't used to analyzing what, you know, people used for stagecraft and things like that. Yeah. They would just see something. And again, it was on a television that was, you know, not as good, depending on your antenna.
I think it was another Fourth Doctor's episode where they had been hinting and building the suspense about the monster so much that it was so scary that they got a record number of complaints. The monster was a trash bag. But it was just a quick cut of a trash bag.
I mean, we'll get later into what this monster evolves into, but the thought of whatever that is, it's pretty frightening.
Oh,
yeah. Vira notices Dune, their technician, is missing from the pod with the slime. Sarah Jane and Harry revive the Doctor as Noah returns, left hand in pocket. Vira revives another technician, Libri, who is scared of Noah. Noah orders Vira to stop reviving people. She says she needs technicians since Dune is missing, but he says he is Dune. The Doctor examines Dune's empty pod and suspects the insect used his body to house her eggs. Libri finds Noah but can't shoot him. Noah kills Libri and then pulls his hand from his pocket. He has started to change into a larva.
Gross.
It's a little weird. Because I'm thinking this is older, and I wouldn't think something like that cerebral.
Right, well, that's what I was impressed with.
I was like, oh, yeah, wow, you guys went there.
Yeah. On the page and idea-wise, there's a lot of stuff in this story arc that I found to be just as modern as today.
Well, it reminded me of Jurassic Park, in that they take some bit of information they found in reality and then made it into something of a whole storyline. And here he's talking about the Amenez wasp, I think is what they said, and how it lays its eggs in caterpillars, and so it has a food source. And I tried to look that up, and what I found is that they stun caterpillars or insects and leave it in the nest when they lay their eggs, so that when the eggs hatch, then they have something to eat, but they don't actually lay it in the caterpillar.
But I've heard of different things where some bugs and things do that. I actually think it was even frogs. Like, there are, they lay eggs in, like, some of the frog's or toad's warty pocket, and then, like, it eats the frog as it hatches.
A thing we were talking about before I found inconsistent, but Frank figured this out, was when the Doctor gets stunned with the gun, and then it goes to shoot Libri, it kills Libri. I was like, that's inconsistent with the logic of that gun, but then Frank mentioned.
It's on a different setting from what I can tell, because when they shoot the Doctor, he glows around and then collapses. Mm-hmm. When he shoots Libri, it's showing an odd pattern of not really a circle, but a scalloped kind of circle.
But it seems more concentrated,
it's
right?
It's concentrated on his chest. Well, it's also, so it was a different visual effect that they used to show, no, this one's more intense.
Well, that happened after he stunned the Doctor, though, yes?
Yes, after.
Yes, so he's probably turning more evil anyhow. That's one thing. And another thing, too, is he knew Libri had information, right, Libri? He shoots like he was more of a threat.
Right, and it was Noah who shot the Doctor, who wanted just to stun him. And it was Dune/Noah who shot Libri. And that's part of the, I think, directing and acting of, I am Dune. It's me. Come on. You know, and it would be done differently now. And it's hard to accept.
It was very much like a play. I mean, you got to watch these like it was a play. You wouldn't really think much about it.
Yeah, I kind of hit the point where I'm going to watch this for Tom Baker's characterization of the Doctor. So I started to watch him rather than the plot.
But I like to chalk that up to, this is for kids. So we need to know that this is Dune, this is Noah, and then this is tortured Noah.
Yeah, it's very bonk bonk.
That could be it too. Like, they could be, this maybe has a much slower pace, so the kids have time to figure out what's going on.
Everything had a much slower pace in the 70s, though. Everything had a much slower pace in the 80s. It wasn't until MTV style editing that things really did.
I remember
pick
someone
up.
Was talking about an episode of Mannix the other day, and he had to go to like
fly a Quinn Martin production.
He had to fly to Los Angeles or something. So you see him go to the airport. The camera shows him get out of the cab. He walks into the airport. He walks across the airport. Yeah. He walks onto the plane. The plane takes off. The plane flies. The plane lands. He walks out of the plane. He walks through the airport. He walks out of the airport. He gets in a car.
And that's the syndicated. That's a syndicated version, because in the real version, when the first aired, he also bought his ticket.
That's true.
Had a cigarette before getting on the plane.
What made me really think about it, I'm jumping ahead, is when the ladder gets lowered at the end.
Yeah.
To me,
yeah.
I was like, that must be like, all right, we paid money for this ladder motor. We're going to use it.
Well, back to plane flying, I thought, if it was an emergency, he'd just fly by map, like Indiana Jones.
Right, yeah. Even in the 40s, they knew how to do it more interesting.
But I think it's also part of the 70s, because thanks to you, I remembered Sigmund and the Sea Monster and those type of morning shows.
Mm-hmm. Lidsville.
I never watched it. Lidsville, that wasn't on.
H.R. Puffin stuff.
The Bugaloos.
Well, that's the end of the second episode that we're at.
Yeah, the cliffhanger for this second episode isn't as great. I'm going to pull it out of my left pocket. Got a green hand.
I don't know. If I was a kid and I saw someone transforming into some sort of larva thing, that would freak me the heck out.
There's one coming up that's even worse, but I feel like the first one was the best. And then they were getting progressively less cliffhanger-y frightening. the guy playing Noah didn't, there's just something about his acting that didn't sell it. Where like,
oh yeah, right.
And so I think that the combination of it being old and the acting not being the best makes me not like this cliffhanger as much.
Right. But going into the third episode, it has the announcement about the space station Nerva and the way she's talking and just drawing out what she's saying is not a way anybody would actually ever speak.
Right, because it's futuristic, unemotional trope.
I think this was very heavily influenced by 2001, from the clothes to the set. You know, and you know Hal, the way Hal talked. What year was 2001? Does anyone know?
69.
68, 69. Yeah. Duh, it's in the name.
Oh my gosh, that was 17 years ago.
I wouldn't even have been surprised if it was a computer voice. Like,
it was definitely a person because Harry makes a sexist comment about it. Well, this must make your feminist heart really happy.
Yeah, yeah.
A woman in charge. The doctor has a great line here with Sarah. Sarah thinks he's joking, and he's like, "When I say I'm afraid, Sarah, I'm not making jokes." So it's like, wow, even the doctor is scared at this point. So
I did like that.
I like that line a lot.
Coming from this future watcher to a classic watcher, I was surprised how much they called her Sarah rather than Sarah Jane. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they really did just call her Sarah.
Yeah.
And it's in the modern show where she makes a... or in Sarah Jane Adventures, where she makes a big deal about being called Sarah Jane.
Noah is fighting the change and orders Vira over the intercom to continue reviving the people and get them back to Earth as soon as possible. He tells them the insects are the Wyrn and they will absorb the humans. Sarah Jane and Harry continue reviving the other technicians, Lysette and Rogan, while Vira and the doctor go to find Noah. When they do, the change has covered more of his body. The larvae are growing quickly and will soon be adults. The doctor halts the reviving of the others until they can figure out how to stop the Wyrn.
Oh, I think Noah's acting got better after he had to put on more costume.
Yeah.
And Kelsey, you remind me, this point was kind of confusing as a viewer. I don't know if my rip got weird or
okay, so what
happened.
What were you confused about? Because it is
well, one second.
Noah's exit.
Yeah, one second. He has the gun on them and then
disappeared.
And then the gun throws down on the foot of the doctor.
Yes.
We thought he exploded off camera.
Or they dropped the gun because of the change.
Yeah, I think
well, they're between a doorway, and I just assumed the door closed.
Originally in production, in the story, in the script, his head was supposed to split open.
Ooh.
And some stuff was supposed to come out.
Okay.
Oh.
And then I can see that they're just like, let's just cut it. And then...
yeah. Well, I got that. Something gross was happening off camera.
Yeah. Because didn't he kind of like start to convulse, do something?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's reacting and he's angry and he's agitated. And
I agree, though. The editing is bad at this point.
Well, and I think it also hurts that right before this, all of the back and forth with Noah and the rest of the crew, like, we're going to revive the people. No, don't revive the people. Now we're going to do this.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of confusing stuff happening very quickly and just kind of capped
and
it.
And later on, I caught on to, oh, he's conflicted with his own humanity and the alien, but...
I think we needed a reason. Like, why would reviving everybody help the Wyrn? Why would not help the Wyrn? Like, I think it was just so much stuff was happening, but there wasn't a connection to...
The same character would want to revive everybody and then not want to revive anybody. And then, so it's not just one character, but all of them kind of changed depending on what was going on.
Yeah,
and you
had
to try and keep up with what is going on, what is best.
Plus, they didn't really explain 100% what the plan exactly was, because then they mentioned, too, that they were asleep for longer, but the Earth ended up being okay. Like, there are actually people on the Earth. Like, it didn't...
Yeah, this actually is referenced in the modern show, too. There was a period of time when there were solar flares that made the Earth uninhabitable, but then the solar flares, and they knew it when the solar flares were happening, that the sun would eventually stop and the Earth would become habitable again. So that's how you can have the Earth is technically destroyed for a little while, but the doctor could travel into the future and be on Earth. This is the, so this happened in the 30th century, and in the modern show, it's the 11th Doctor story, The Beast Below, where it has the Starship UK.
Remember that? In a space whale.
And the space whale.
Oh, right.
And that was because of the solar flares on Earth. Then there was also the 12th Doctor episode, Smile, which has the little emoji robots killing everybody. There was a colony of humans who left Earth because of the solar flares.
There's a bunch of heaven's gators.
Yeah, they kept it consistent within the timeline, which is nice.
And right. In this series, they did say that they were supposed to be asleep for 5,000 years, but then it's closer to 10,000.
That's exactly why the technicians are upset, and they say, we would have been better off with the solar flares because we'd be dead. Happily dead and not having to deal with this monster crisis up here in space. But I thought he meant
we would have been safe on Earth and lived our life, and then we'd be dead now.
I took it both ways.
Because it wasn't just staying on Earth. There were people staying on Earth that were supposed to be protected and live underground.
I like that one technician, that Neil Diamond guy. I liked him.
The doctor taps into the insect they found earlier, the Wern Queen, and experiences her last memories. She was killed by the auto defenses, and he finds out that electricity can be used against them. One of the larvae kills Lysit, but Rogan, Harry, and Vyra drive it back to the air vents. The doctor wants to electrify part of the ship, but the power keeps being turned off. He goes to the station's power source, where Noah, now nearly completely transformed, stops him from fixing the power. Vyra comes in and stuns Noah. Noah wants Vyra and the other awakened crew to get on a shuttle and leave. He will order the other Wern not to harm them as they leave, but the other sleeping humans will be used to rebuild their race. She refuses, and Sarah Jane comes up with a plan to use the shuttle to send power to electrify the ship. She will carry the power cable through the ducts to where the doctor needs it.
Even though it went on too long, I thought the part where he's mind-melding with the alien's cornea was very doctor-y. Like, it was very in the vein of the show, and I like that a lot.
I like the way that Sarah Jane protected him during that scene.
Yes, yes.
This is a Sarah Jane I remember and like, and she's the one who comes up with the idea of the alternate power source, the shuttle, and which the doctor keeps poo-pooing her. No, the grown-ups are talking kind of attitude, and so she just waits. Well, the shuttle has its own power source, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, then he appreciates her.
What were you going to say? What I was going to say.
Because all his plans don't work. Everybody's going, that can't work. That can't work because of this. And it's not just negativity. It's practical. That cannot work. So I like it that Sarah Jane does that. And then she's the one who can fit into the ducts. Right.
And I think there's a line from the fourth doctor. He says that humans are his favorite. And this is why.
Yes.
Yeah, and I found that reminded me of our current doctor and Tennant. I think there's even a line that the doctor says here that I've heard Tennant as the doctor say.
Probably.
And I should have written it down to ask, is that a line that all the doctors say? Or is it when you mentioned that this is one of Tennant's favorite episodes?
Russell and Stephen Moffat.
Oh, I thought she said Russell and David Tennant. Oh.
I did notice how much Tom Baker puts his hands in his pockets.
Almost steps on his scarf. Well, or does step on his scarf.
And now, in these early episodes, he ties it close around his neck and then it hangs down. So when he steps on it, he's choking himself. I think it's in later episodes where he doesn't do that anymore.
Okay, he has a larger
loop. It's a large loop.
Okay.
Did it one too many times.
Because it is earlier on in his incarnation.
Yes.
So he's learning that. I also like Sarah Jane explaining what he's doing with the electricity, because I'm thinking, if you're going to electrify the whole, you're electrifying everybody. But she's like, oh, like an electric fence. So we're just keeping them out of where all the humans are. So I'm glad it's a simple line, but I needed that visual.
This is also a moment where I realized you guys really didn't think this set design through. I think they're going to transmat to the command room. And this is where he's turning the power off, right? So Sarah Jane goes up into the transmat, and then the power goes out. That was the moment when I realized, why is the transmat up above the console without any way of getting to it? I mean, you literally have to step on the console, and the doctor has, you have to have a second human being pick you up off of the console. It's like, that is the stupidest place for a transmat.
I can hand wave that for you if you'd like.
Oh, please.
Because originally that was the second bed. So they would bring a person into that first bed where they laid Sarah Jane, and then it would transmat to that pod,
right,
where then they would get cryo-freezed.
Right.
And we didn't see it, but apparently there's some automated process to put them with everybody else.
I agree with you. I agree with that.
And the doctor reversed the transmat so that he could use that to back.
No, that's good.
I rescind
that's
my...
what I was going to do.
you levitate and then float into the...
It was still fun watching them climb up that into the...
Going back to the scarf, the doctor mentions that his scarf was knitted by Madame Nostradamus.
Oh, is that what he said? I couldn't catch the name.
But in production-wise, the production costumer person was given a whole bunch of yarn with the idea that you make a bunch of scarves for... like different usage. No. And then she took all of that yarn, made one long scarf.
Is
and
that that's true? How,
yes, that's true.
That's I thought it was they gave her yarn to make a scarf.
Mm-hmm.
And she just kept going.
She just
didn't know what it meant. Is this the point where we find out the history of the Wyrn when he's in the memory? Is
yeah,
this it?
Yeah,
it was like the humans stuns found him. And he tells, and...
Vira.
Oh, sorry. Vira stuns him.
Vira was on Noah, Alice.
And Noah tells them about the Wyrn, saying, no, the humans are the ones who caused us to lose our planet. Right.
So when this Noah is literally...
But Noah talks to them.
This is literally a Starship Troopers episode.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
Yeah, Klandathu.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that the Wyrn were not really as... It didn't seem like a very sentient race. They used to feed off of cattle and things. So they didn't have that much intelligence from what I'm picking up from this, because now that they've absorbed humans and their brain and how they do it, they become a lot more aggressive. And are now going to...
That's interesting. I like that.
That's what I picked up from his conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I do like that they're absorbing humans and getting more aggressive. That's cool.
Yeah.
The Wyrn try to stop them, but Rogan and Vira use the shuttle's engines to fight them off. In the duct, Sarah Jane gets stuck. At the opening, the doctor tells her that she's useless, and they never should have relied on a girl like her. Angrily, she makes it through and realizes why the doctor taunted her. The electricity stops the Wyrn from coming into the section of the ship, but Noah decides to turn off the oxygen. The doctor tries to remind Noah that he was once human, while the Wyrn tried to reach the bridge by breaking into the shuttle's cargo hold. Vira sets the shuttle to take off on autopilot with the Wyrn inside. Rogan and the doctor release the clamps securing the shuttle, but Rogan is killed when the shuttle takes off. Noah calls Vira from the shuttle to say goodbye, and then, with his last bit of humanity, destroys the shuttle, killing the Wyrn. Vira plans to awaken the rest of the people, but will have to transmit them to Earth since the shuttle is gone. The doctor notices that the receiving transmit will not work properly and leaves with Sarah Jane and Harry to fix it on Earth.
When the engines go off and it just has that steam, it just reminds me of bug spray. So it's like, just bug spraying them down.
Great.
The doctor taunting Sarah.
Well, it's also like what happened in, again, The Poison Sky, where he taunts Donna into doing, like, you can do it, you can... Get out of there.
But yes, in a different way.
A different way, yeah.
Yeah. He belittles Sarah Jane.
Yeah, but yes. I didn't mind it. I think Tom Baker's acting in that scene, you could tell that he was doing it to motivate, because he knew Sarah Jane.
Right.
And he knew that this was like getting her angry at him is what was going to get her through, get her unstuck and get her through to the other end. As a woman, I didn't mind it.
I liked it, and I agree totally with what you're saying. But on another level, I also see it as a very male perspective of women empowerment, because it's basically she had to be reminded that women are strong. Whereas if it was written today, it may have been just more about like something about her as a person rather than her as a woman.
Maybe.
Just devil's advocating it.
Well, I did like how he said he was very proud of her when she came out.
Yeah.
And she got it right away going, you conned me.
You
did it. You manipulated me. Oh, good. Okay, I could do it.
It was very interesting for me to see Sarah Jane, because I've only known her from this day and age. So it was cool. It was interesting.
School reunion.
School reunion, and I watched this last after I watched all the Sarah Jane adventures.
Oh.
And I also like how when she's, I don't need your help getting out of the duct, and he just turns around and says, yes, you do. And she's like, all right, pull me out.
I feel like if this was done today, like in the current Doctor Who, we would have a scene between Bug Noah and the Doctor where the Doctor gives him a choice, like leave.
They do kind of.
They kind of do it, but it's not as, like...
It's not focused on.
It's not as... it's kind of
there. Yes, it's
there.
Not a moment.
But it's a reverse moment, because no one does say, you guys take the shuttle and leave, and I'll let them leave. So you have your choice, either stay here and die, or leave. It's almost a reversed moment of that. And who's the one who... Rogan, knowing that, whoever stays behind is going to die.
Yeah, I really
love
his line.
About the union?
Yeah, I love that line. This is my job. You don't want trouble with the space tech's union.
He knocks out the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, and then puts the doctor in safety and then releases the last clamp, which will then start the engines and know that he's going to be fried.
And he has that little moment like a few minutes before where he obviously thought of something and then kind of kept going. And I wasn't sure what it was about. I don't think he was supposed to, but I really like it in hindsight.
I do like that moment a lot.
I think it's a lot still of the mentality of people who've lived through and grown up with parents who've lived through the World War II and what sacrifices mm-hmm. you had to make. Mm.
It's like Rogan is kind of like, no, doctor, you need to live and I'll willingly sacrifice my life.
Well, he often puts himself in a sacrificial position and just ends up getting out of it.
Yes.
So even in this show, didn't he do that a couple times already where he basically did something, no, doctor, it'll kill you. And he's like, well, then I'll die or
yeah,
something
right.
like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's not more like, it's not, I would see it as more of a positive thing because it's not like, well, you guys have to die for me. It's basically like he almost killed himself a number of times thinking he was going to die.
Yes.
And I know this will work.
And don't get me wrong, I don't think it's a bad thing. Stephen Moffat
does. But death still does follow the doctor.
Yeah, Stephen Moffat thinks it's a bad thing.
And in one of our most recent episodes that we've done, I found this ending scene very much like The Poison Sky, where he has to blow up the Centauran ship and he's the one on there.
Yeah.
And then Radagon switches places and it's very much the same motif and...
Centaur.
Yeah, yeah. Same stuff that goes on here.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the consistency in the Doctor's yeah. character.
I mean, we don't have the bad guy turning into a good guy at the last yeah. moment because Rogan's always a good guy, but
we have the same
it's the instantaneous.
Situation. And then backing up a little bit to what we mentioned about the ladder from the shuttle. Mm-hmm. When you look at the production of that, I'm like, isn't that the exhaust port?
And then, yeah, who knows?
And then the...
Oh, that's very common, though, in the 50s to have...
I know, but I'm just saying from what I am aware of things, it, yeah. the way it was designed, it looked like that would be the engine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it opened up to be a ladder. Yeah. Like...
A ladder what? That I remember having to paint our house.
But one good thing I will say about that, it's lit very darkly, so you don't see much of the rocket. Mm-hmm. So you're like, there could be a real rocket there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, you don't know what's above lit. The camera.
I like the lighting in that instance. It mm-hmm. helped with the video.
And it wasn't even blue.
That's right.
We didn't mention this when it happened, but the ray guns that they ended up getting from the armory were a lot of fun, I thought.
I mean,
and by fun, you mean?
Quite an interesting take on the ray gun.
Like Rogan, I think it's Rogan, is really pressing that flower yeah. to come out of the barrel.
They were all really like acting with the guns and gesticulating their
yes.
every bolt that they fired.
But the one, to go off of what you said, when they're really repelling the big maggot, I was like, that maggot is really impressive.
Yeah.
They got the bubble wrap to make those appendages, whatever that were. I was like, and you couldn't really see the guy inside where no. you think you could.
I was always looking for the guy inside, and I never could really figure out where everything was.
I thought that was very impressive with bubble wrap.
I would give him that one.
Yeah.
That one I thought looked pretty good. It reminded me of that whatever microscopic bug that is inside us that they now make in everything.
Oh, yeah. From Discovery?
Yeah.
I'll think of it.
Water bears? Is that
yes.
something?
Yes, but yeah. the real name of them.
But anyway, if that was done today, that would still be frightening because like a big maggot looks... Ugh.
They wouldn't have to change too much to make it work today. No. I think it's like, no, they did well on that
yes,
one.
Yes, they
that
did.
That one, yeah, I'll give you.
It looks like an alien insect. Good job.
Brought to you by Bubble Wrap.
I'll say after watching the whole thing, and I just looked up some movie dates because I was like, oh, they must have got their inspiration from some of these movies. But like Alien, like that whole kind of ship and idea and something transforming you.
I have that note.
Alien
note
was
too.
79.
Well, this was 75.
75. Though.
Yeah. No, that's what I'm surprised at how ahead of its time mm-hmm. or how much influence this might have had on these later movies.
Right, right. And being frozen and woken up.
Right.
Well, even with Aliens, where Bishop is going through the chute, just like Sarah Jane
yes.
was going through the chute.
And they use the engines to clear out
yes.
the xenomorphs
yes.
a little bit. Mm-hmm. The Fly, which was 58, but the one I know is from 89.
Right.
But that's also kind of that transformation, the way that Noah transformed. And then even Evil Dead, like when Noah's hand is going mm-hmm. crazy, he's sitting there like fighting against his hand. Mm-hmm. That's a very... you know, Evil Dead was 81, so that's something that Sam Raimi is known for, and like that's one of his calling cards. But here it is in yeah. a Doctor Who episode 5 years before.
Wouldn't be surprised if
he's probably a fan of
yeah
of Doctor Who.
5 years before Evil Dead
or 6 years. Evil Dead was 81.
81.
Oh, I guess so. That was the first one though.
Yes.
Not Evil Dead 2.
Correct.
I do want to mention the name of the creature.
Yes.
Because it's kind of an appropriate name. Uh-oh. It is a tardigrade.
Mm.
So the creature is a tardigrade.
something that really bugged me about the ending of the show was the transmat is not working properly, and the doctor says there's something wrong with the part receiver that's on Earth. So let's go down there and fix it. And he doesn't use the TARDIS.
Yeah, I thought
he uses the transmat that's not working to go down and fix what's not working.
Yeah.
It's like, you have a TARDIS. You even go to the TARDIS so you can change clothes for the next serial.
And they could have actually...
But it's unpredictable, though, right? Like, how...
Oh, so you know, you kind of have a...
So if he's like, I'm going to take my TARDIS down to Earth...
They might not hit it.
He might end up on Earth 10,000 years earlier, right as the solar flares are happening.
But at the beginning of
the series,
he didn't
take the TARDIS.
He says he doesn't know where he is because Harry was hitting buttons. So either he's just blaming Harry and using a scapegoat... Or
I'm just talking about
this incarnation, the Doctor gets the TARDIS better.
Oh, does he? And, yes, okay, he does. I didn't know that.
So he can land it a little bit better. And he could play it down. He doesn't have to go through time and space. It's like, we want to go to the same time period. It's right over there. We could just fly it down. It does fly.
For a spaceship, she doesn't really fly in space much.
Right.
You know, I mean, the real reason is because they wanted to go like five or six complete serials, without using the TARDIS set to save money.
Because the next episode is the Centauran experiment, I believe.
Yes.
And it continues right after this, where they go on Earth.
See? Auburn said that. I was like, oh, I want to watch the next episode. Auburn's like, well, it's not going to be about this. It's going to be a whole new adventure.
That's why
But they're repairing the transmat. Yeah.
But that's why this season with Tom Baker, I would just want to point out that it's very much... This happens before this episode, and then it just continues as opposed to...
There's a linear line.
Like kind of standalone, like this is done, and then we have this other that could
take... And that was new? Outside. That was the first time that Doctor Who was doing this?
This is the year where everything changes. We actually have a season that continues from one episode to another.
They're standalone.
They're
standalone stories, but the beginning and the end kind of...
So they do get back...
Lead into each other.
Yes. They lead into each other.
That's cool. And this is like, new
but not after this next series. So then they go on to something else, and then they come back to this.
Oh, God.
Later.
So how long are they sitting up there waiting for him?
Well, time's relative.
Why me?
Dimension and space. I wanted to point out John Friedlander. He was the special effects person on this episode, and he's the one that came up with the bubble wrap and the Wyrn. And previously we've seen him do the Master's Mask in Terror of the Autons and the Mask of Lynx, the Centauran commander in The Time Warrior. And then later we'll see him do Davros.
The guy likes masks.
And then Stuart Fell was the Wyrn Grub, the guy crawling in the the plastic.
Stuart Fell?
Yeah. He was a stuntman on Terror of the Autons.
A stuntman with the last name of Fell.
Yes, I see. I see
that's
the irony.
Destiny.
And then he goes on to do Alpha Centauri, which is not my favorite. So, final thoughts. The Ark in Space. Josh.
I like Tom Baker.
Hold on, let me
I'm done! Let me prompt you.
I also like Tom Candlestick Maker and Tom Butcher. Thank you.
Rub-a-dub-dub.
I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. I thought that it was very slow, but a lot of stuff was happening story-wise that made me interested. And Tom Baker's just interesting to watch. Again, my only complaint is I kind of want to snap my fingers. All right. What are you trying to say that you could say in just two sentences? But he's really interesting, and I could see why he just looks like a cartoon. And even though the other doctors did as well, he's just got such a presence. And it's this weird, creepy yet lovable thing that's happening. Whereas I think the other doctors were just weird.
Ark in Space. I think I enjoyed it. It definitely has some pacing issues, but I think story-wise has some really interesting ideas that, like I said, I think, you know, are explored more later in other science fiction. This was actually my first time seeing Tom Baker. That was interesting. I'm not there yet with him just because, like, this is my first time seeing him. I'm sure he's better in some other things, but I will continue to watch more of his work in the show, and maybe Kelsey and I will catch the next episode to see what happens after they transmat to Earth.
So, Ark in Space. yeah, as an episode, it's okay. but like, I enjoyed watching this episode as a way to get to know Tom Baker as the Doctor. I think this was like my first episode I've ever seen of him. yeah, it like Albrin said, it's the first time you're watching someone play the Doctor, and that's always a little difficult. Like, you're not gonna immediately love that actor or that portrayal of the Doctor, but there's enough similarities that you can compare and that you're like, you're okay with it. These are classic. This is a classic episode, so it's a whole different way of playing the Doctor. What I found interesting was how it's easier in the classic episodes to be reminded that the Doctor is alien. I enjoyed the Doctor and I enjoyed Sarah Jane in this episode, but the episode overall, it was okay.
For me, I'm very average on this episode. It's not one of Doctor Who's or even Tom Baker's best. Certainly also not one of their worst. I'm very middle of the road. It's one of those things, I don't know if I would seek this episode out, but if it were on TV, I'd probably watch it. I love Tom Baker. He is very alien. He gets even more alien as the portrayal continues. And, you know, Tennant is very human, so, you know, it's a good contrast. I liked it. And Sarah Jane calls Harry a twit. So
I wanted more Sarah Jane than Harry, though. I got tired of Harry.
I'll tell you a little bit about Harry as story-wise. So when they
regarding Henry,
something about Harry.
I'm just wild about Harry.
When John Pertwee was leaving, they were thinking that they were going to cast another older actor in the role of the Doctor. So they wanted Harry to be a new companion to do most of the action sequences.
To run.
And then when Tom Baker was casted, he was the youngest Doctor, the person to play the Doctor at the time. So then Harry became kind of superfluous, and then he got written out.
I would like to know how many times in this era of Doctor Who, how close, like when they were writing, like when they were shooting episode one, did everybody know how episode four ends?
They probably, at the very least, I'm sure they must have had an outline. They may not have scripted it.
But things changed, like with the last serial of the first Doctor, he got sick, so then they had to quickly rewrite around that. Well, so you never knew back then.
Well, they probably had their just ideas, and then they were like, so we'll use this for the four episode story arc. And someone was like, well, that's not enough material for four episodes. We'll make it work.
Right. I mean, I'm sure they were like, okay, the Doctor encounters the humans on a arc in space. Go write it. Right. And something goes wrong.
And make it four episodes long.
So I'm just wondering, like, when you know, they are filming them getting off of the TARDIS and not being able to breathe, do they know that at the end, Noah's going to sacrifice himself and blow?
So I would think that's more...
We'll see.
No, but I think they have it more outlined than that.
This one was an original idea.
Because they have to spread it out. Because they have... Here's a four episode... Sorry.
Because this one was an original idea by another writer, and then they hired Robert Holmes to finish it.
Yeah, but that's not the norm.
I know, but I mean, I'm saying that they probably had that idea.
Yeah, okay.
Of the ending.
But you know, I still wonder.
I agree. I think especially for something like this, they probably knew like the act outs or the cliffhangers for each episode. But it's like, okay, we got 20 minutes to get to a bug jumping out of the closet. Right. We got 20 minutes to get to that hand. Yeah. How do we do that? Yeah.
Breathe slower.
Show.
And they did.
All the pieces going together. We got to connect everything. But this wasn't as bad though as some previous episodes.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It's not one I would introduce to a new viewer to watch the classic series or the Baker series.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah.
But then Kelsey made a good point that nowadays he's very human and there is some alienness to him in this, which is good. There are glimpses of who I think, you know, Tom Baker's Doctor and Sarah Jane, but I don't think it was written well on some of that. I don't think it was acted or directed particularly well. I think the story was pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, you dissect the story, but I don't think it was told well or executed well.
I think if I was a kid, I would not have been able to follow the depth of the story at all, the way they sold it.
I think talking about this and doing this podcast helped me remember, and I hate just going on to this one tangent all the time, but Sigmund and the Sea Monster. You know, so it put back into perspective what was going on in children's programming and how they kind of spoke down to kids, or just, well, not maybe not spoke down, just had fun and just went crazy with some of the kids' programming. Putting it in some of that perspective and thinking of the last two episodes of the series, it's not as horrible as I thought of when I was trying to watch it. Because the first two...
Which series?
Of this series of the arc serial.
Gotcha. I thought you were talking about like a season. No,
just these four episodes. Gotcha. The first two were hard to get through, and then started picking up. And I think Sarah Jane and the Doctor were more of themselves in the third and fourth, maybe because they had more practical things to do, yeah, and they had a plan.
I think I'm the only one that really likes this episode because I think this was my first Tom Baker episode. I saw this years ago, like maybe 10 years ago, even before the podcast was an idea. And it kept me wondering. And then I went on to seek out other Tom Baker episodes and even classic episodes. But what I really, and then doing the research on this, I really like how the chemistry between Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor, Sarah Jane and Harry, this is their second serial together, and they're just clicking to me.
Yeah, I would say that. I would say that feel. Yeah. That's why I was surprised to hear there was only one episode before this with Tom Baker, because it feels like they're as kind of dull as I find Harry, I found them to be very integrated. Mm-hmm.
And then the stagecraft to me is very impressive in this. I mean,
yeah, I would agree.
Like those corridors, the starfield, the
lighting, being used.
And then I have a little trivia bit here that Vira was written to be possibly Haitian, and then it was changed later.
Oh, hey!
So who knows what would have been.
She was going to be Haitian.
Another thing I wanted to point out was the hatch is triangle, so it makes me think they did that on purpose to make it not modern, like it's a futuristic trait.
Maybe they couldn't afford a fourth piece of the hatch.
No, because there's a panel for the controls in a later scene, and he pulls it, and it's a triangle again. So I like
a rectangle.
Triangle.
Oh.
So, yeah, but the duct is a rectangle.
No, the duct is...
No,
it's a triangle.
Is
it a triangle? It's a triangle.
Oh. When he pulls her out of there?
And yeah. I figure they just did that to make it hard for her to go through.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It could
she
be that.
She must have loved filming those scenes.
It could be that, but I also like that it makes it not present.
Right.
It makes it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And little things like that I noticed on this second watching for me. But really, that's it. I just like the chemistry between the main leads. Mm-hmm. So that wraps up The Ark in Space. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time when the future becomes the present.
You've just listened to an episode of Who Knew?
Our wonderful theme music is by Michael Grady.
Find him on Facebook at The Universe Explodes.
All our episodes are engineered by Auburn.
Find him at auburnbinkley.com.
You can find this show in several places.
Follow us on Twitter at Who Knew Podcast.
Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast.
Visit our Facebook page.
Please leave comments, reviews, and click like to help support Who Knew Podcast.
Also listen to us on your Amazon Echo by enabling a podcast skill.
All our episodes are on whoknewpodcast.com.
This podcast is inspired by Doctor Who,
the longest-running sci-fi show in history.
And especially the revival spearheaded by Russell T. Davis.
Thanks to Russell,
Sydney Newman,
Verity Lambert,
Ron Grainer,
and all those involved in the adventures of our favorite Time Lord.
Your work continues to inspire and entertain.
Yeah, we can do mic checks real quick, sorry.
Hey, Mike, how you doing? This is a mic check. I'm just seeing how you're doing. That's all.
Uba duta solo, san bichale, manichachika, manichika.
I'm impressed.
Cool. There's a plane. We can't hear that, right?
I can't.
I don't even hear it.
You're probably fine.
You're just hearing planes.
No, it was there.
That's a condition.
Conditioner. Air conditioner.
Oh. Yeah, it's a condition we call air conditioner.
Airplane for men. Now an ocean breeze. All right.
He leaves and tells the doctor, God damn it.
I don't think they used that terminology back then.
Bollocks.
Very colonial.
There you go.
Is she missing the
target?
Never mind, keep talking and we'll let me out.